A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a deceptively layered question. He's asking about the Talmud, not just what it is, but what religious Jews actually believe about the status of the arguments inside it. Are the disagreements themselves considered divine, or just the conclusions? And if the conclusions are already settled and applied through established legal traditions, then what does learning even mean in the context of Talmud study? It's not like you're discovering new information the way a secular researcher would. So what's actually happening when someone spends years in a beat midrash?
Oh, this is good. And before we dive in, quick note, today's script is being generated by DeepSeek V4 Pro, so if anything sounds unusually coherent, that's why.
I was going to say the opposite, but sure.
The first thing to understand is that Daniel's question cuts right to something that confuses a lot of people approaching the Talmud from the outside. You open it up expecting something like a catechism or a legal code, and instead you get what looks like a transcript of a very heated dinner party that's been going on for centuries. Arguments, tangents, stories, a rabbi disagreeing with another rabbi who lived 300 years earlier, and then a third rabbi shows up 4 generations later to say they were both missing the point.
Which is either maddening or thrilling depending on your temperament. I remember the first time I actually sat down with a page of Gemara, and I had this moment of genuine disorientation. I'd been told this was the foundational legal text of Rabbinic Judaism, and I'm reading what amounts to a transcript of 3rd-century Babylonian academics having a multi-generational argument about a collapsed courtyard wall, and I kept thinking, is this it? Am I missing something? And then about 40 minutes in, something clicked, and I realized the courtyard wall wasn't really about the courtyard wall.
That's the experience. And it's exactly the right example, because the surface topic is almost never the whole point. But the theological question underneath it is serious. Orthodox Judaism holds that the oral law was given at Sinai alongside the written law. This isn't a fringe position, it's foundational. When Moses received the Torah, he received both the text and an accompanying body of interpretation and legal tradition that was transmitted orally for generations, until it was eventually compiled in the Mishnah around the year 200.
This is where it gets interesting, because transmitted orally sounds like a game of telephone, and you'd expect the tradition to acknowledge some degradation over time. But the traditional view is the opposite. The oral transmission was precise, and the rabbis of the Mishnah were preserving, not innovating.
Right, though not innovating, needs some unpacking. The Mishnah itself is this remarkably concise legal code. It's organized by topic, it's systematic, it gives rulings on everything from Sabbath boundaries to marriage contracts to agricultural tithes. And it almost never cites its sources. It just states the law, which is part of why the Gemara became necessary.
Because people wanted to know where this stuff came from.
Whether it was correct, and what to do when the Mishnah contradicts itself or leaves gaps. The Gemara is essentially 3 centuries of Babylonian and Palestinian rabbis analyzing the Mishnah, and I mean analyzing it to an almost absurd degree. They trace every ruling back to its scriptural source. They compare parallel cases, they probe for inconsistencies, they explore hypothetical edge cases. It's not a commentary in the modern sense. It's more like watching a legal system think out loud.
Can I push on that phrase to an almost absurd degree? Because I think that's exactly the thing that trips people up. Give me a concrete example of what that level of analysis actually looks like in practice.
There's a famous extended discussion in Tractate Bava Kamma about damages caused by an ox. The Mishnah distinguishes between an ox that's tam, innocent, meaning it hasn't gored before, and an ox that's muad, forewarned, meaning it's gored 3 times and the owner should have known it was dangerous. For a tam ox, the owner pays half damages. For a muad, full damages. But then the Gemara spends pages and pages on this. What if the ox gored a cow that was pregnant? Do you pay for the cow, the fetus, both? What if the ox was provoked by a child throwing stones? What if the ox gored on a Tuesday, but the owner only found out on Thursday? What if two oxen gored each other simultaneously? It's this relentless pressure testing of every possible boundary condition.
From the outside, that looks like legal pedantry run amok. But what's actually happening?
What's actually happening is they're building a system of tort law from a few verses in Exodus. Every one of those hypotheticals forces you to articulate the underlying principle more precisely. When you've worked through all of them, you don't just know the rule, you understand the legal theory of liability in a way that lets you handle cases the text never dreamed of. That's the method.
We've got two layers, the Mishnah, which is the codified oral law, and the Gemara, which is the record of the rabbis working through it. And Daniel's question is, are both of these considered divine?
The answer is more nuanced than a yes or no. The traditional view is that the Mishnah represents the authentic transmission of the oral law that originated at Sinai. So the legal content, the halakhic conclusions, are understood to be part of a divinely authorized tradition. But the arguments in the Gemara? That's where the theology gets subtle.
This is the Elu Velu principle, right?
Elu Velu Divre, Elohim Kaim. These and those are the words of the living God. It's a statement that appears in the Talmud itself, in Tractate Eruvin, and it's this remarkable claim that when two rabbis disagree about a matter of law, both positions can be considered divinely legitimate. Not that both are practically followed, you still need to pick one for actual practice, but that both represent authentic engagement with divine truth.
Which raises an obvious question. If God said one thing at Sinai, how can two contradictory positions both be the words of the living God?
This is where the analogy of a prism or a multifaceted gem comes up in a lot of Jewish thought. The idea is that divine truth isn't a single flat proposition. It's something that contains multitudes, and human understanding can only grasp facets of it. When the rabbis argue, they're not one of them correctly remembering Sinai and the other forgetting. They're each accessing a genuine dimension of the truth, and the argument itself is part of what revelation looks like when it enters human discourse.
I've seen people compare it to the way physicists will describe light as both a wave and a particle. Both descriptions are true, and neither is complete, and the tension between them is productive rather than a sign that someone made a mistake.
That's a helpful parallel, though we should be careful not to overextend it. Let me ground this in a concrete example. There's a famous dispute between Hillel and Shammai that runs through the Mishnah, these two schools of thought that disagreed on something like 300 different legal questions. The Talmud in Eruvin says that for 3 years the schools of Hillel and Shammai each insisted the law followed their view, until a heavenly voice declared, Elu Velu, both are the words of the living God, but the law follows Hillel.
The heavenly voice both validates the disagreement, and then picks a winner for practical purposes.
And the Talmud goes on to explain why Hillel's view prevails. Because the school of Hillel was gentle and humble, and when they taught, they would present Shammai's opinion before their own. It's not that Hillel was more correct in a pure truth sense. It's that their approach to discourse was more conducive to building a livable legal system.
Which is a fascinating criterion. You don't win the argument by being more right. You win by being more generous with your opponent's position. Can you imagine if modern courts operated on that principle? Oral arguments, where the justices are graded on how fairly they characterize the other side.
We'd have a very different legal culture. But it's not just a nicety. There's a genuine epistemological claim here. The tradition is saying that how you argue is itself a form of legal reasoning. The process and the substance can't be fully separated. And this connects directly to Daniel's question about why the arguments are preserved at all. If the conclusion is what matters for practice, why not just publish the final ruling and be done with it? Why spend page after page on positions that were ultimately rejected?
I think part of the answer is that rejected is too strong a word. If both positions are words of the living God, then the minority opinion isn't wrong. It's just not the one we follow. It retains a kind of validity.
There's a practical dimension, too. Jewish law continues to develop, and sometimes a minority opinion that wasn't followed for centuries suddenly becomes relevant in a new context. The medieval commentators, the Rishonim, will sometimes revive a minority view from the Talmud and build new law on it. If you'd erased the minority position, you'd have lost that resource.
The Talmud is preserving not just the answer key, but the entire chain of reasoning, including the dead ends and the roads not taken. because you never know when a dead end turns out to be a shortcut under changed circumstances.
That's part of it. But I think there's an even deeper reason, and this gets to the heart of what Daniel's asking about what learning actually means. The Talmud isn't primarily a reference work. It's not a legal database you query when you need a ruling. It's a training ground. The goal of Talmud study isn't just to extract information, it's to develop a certain kind of mind. When you spend years working through the arguments, you're not just learning what the law is, you're learning how to think legally in the Jewish mode. You're internalizing the patterns of reasoning, the categories, the way different principles weigh against each other.
This is the difference between knowing the answer and understanding why the question is framed that way in the first place.
And this is why traditional Jewish learning has always emphasized the process over the product. In a yeshiva, students don't sit and read summaries of Jewish law. They grapple with the original texts, the Mishnah, the Gemara, the medieval commentaries, the later responsa. They argue with each other. They're thrown into the deep end and expected to swim.
I've heard this described as learning to think in a language, rather than just memorizing vocabulary.
The language in this case is the language of halakhic reasoning. Once you've internalized it, you can apply it to new situations that the earlier sources never imagined. Which is essential, because Jewish law has to address everything from electricity on Shabbat to artificial intelligence. The Talmud doesn't have a section on whether you can use a smart speaker on a holiday, but someone trained in Talmudic reasoning can work through the principles and reach a reasoned conclusion.
How does that actually work in practice, though? Walk me through what it looks like when a contemporary rabbi gets a question about something the Talmud couldn't possibly have addressed.
Take electricity on Shabbat. The Talmud obviously never mentions it. But it does have extensive discussions about kindling fire on Shabbat, about completing a circuit, in the sense of completing a vessel or a tool, and about cooking. So a modern posek, a legal decisor, will look at how an electrical circuit works. Is completing a circuit more analogous to kindling a fire, which is prohibited, or to something else? What about an LED? Light that doesn't produce heat the way an incandescent bulb does. Does that change the category? They're not just making things up, they're identifying the relevant Talmudic categories and reasoning by analogy. The categories are ancient, but the analysis is live.
This addresses part of Daniel's question, what learning means in this context. It's not about discovering previously unknown facts, it's about acquiring a mode of reasoning that allows you to participate in an ongoing legal tradition.
But there's another dimension too, and it's the one that's harder to explain to a secular audience. In the traditional Jewish understanding, Talmud study isn't just an intellectual exercise. It's a form of religious practice, arguably the highest form.
Talmud Torah Neged Kulam. The study of Torah is equal to all the other commandments combined.
That's the line from the Mishnah in Pia, and it reflects this idea that when you're studying, you're not just learning about God's will, you're engaging with it directly. The act of study is itself a kind of communion. The medieval philosopher and legal scholar Maimonides writes about this in the Mishnah Torah, that a person should study Torah for its own sake, not for honor or reward, and that this study brings a person to love and fear God.
I want to pause on that phrase, for its own sake, because I think it's doing a lot of work here. In Hebrew, it's lishma, literally for its name, and there's this whole literature about what that means. Is it study without any instrumental goal? Study as pure devotion?
Yes, and the tradition is actually quite realistic about human motivation. The Talmud itself acknowledges that most people start studying for mixed reasons. Prestige, intellectual satisfaction, parental expectation, but the ideal is to reach a point where the study itself is the reward. There's a beautiful passage in the Talmud where Rav Yehuda says that a person should always engage in Torah and mitzvot even if not for their own sake, because from doing it not for its own sake, one eventually comes to do it for its own sake. It's a remarkably psychologically sophisticated view. You don't have to wait for pure motives. You start where you are, and the practice transforms you.
There's a tension here that I think Daniel is pointing at. If the conclusions are already known and the law is already practiced, what's left to study? Aren't you just retreading ground that's been covered for 2,000 years?
This is where the concept of chiddush comes in, innovation or novel insight. Traditional Jewish learning places enormous value on coming up with something new. Not new in the sense of overturning the tradition, but new in the sense of seeing a connection that nobody noticed before, or resolving a difficulty in a clever way, or finding a new application of an old principle.
The text is stable, but the insights are inexhaustible.
That's the belief, yes. And it's borne out by experience. People have been studying the same tractates for millennia, and they still find things to say about them. The Vilna Gaon, the great 18th century Lithuanian sage, reportedly said that every word of Torah has 70 facets, and each of those 70 facets has 70 facets of its own. It's fractal. You can keep going deeper forever.
Which either sounds like profound wisdom or a recipe for obsessive navel-gazing, depending on your disposition.
I mean, it can be both. There's definitely a critique to be made about Talmud study becoming disconnected from practical life. But the tradition has always had a productive tension between the theoretical and the practical. The same rabbis who spent years analyzing the most abstract legal hypotheticals were also answering real questions from their communities about marriage, business, and ritual. Maimonides was a towering Talmudic scholar and also a practicing physician who wrote medical treatises. The ideal has never been the ivory tower. It's the scholar who can move between the abstract and the concrete.
Let's circle back to the divinity question, because I think there's a nuance we haven't quite landed yet. Daniel asked whether religious Jews believe in the divinity of the arguments, not just the conclusions, and the answer seems to be yes and no.
The arguments are not divine in the sense that God dictated them word for word at Sinai. Nobody claims that Abaye and Rava were taking divine dictation when they debated in 4th century Babylonia. But the arguments are divine in the sense that they represent the authentic unfolding of a divinely authorized process. God gave the principles, the methods, the framework, and then entrusted human beings to work out the details.
This is the famous story in the Talmud, in Bava Metzia, about the oven of Achnai.
Oh, this is the perfect example. So there's this dispute about whether a particular type of oven is susceptible to ritual impurity. Rabbi Eliezer says no, the other sages say yes. Rabbi Eliezer says, if I'm right, let this carob tree prove it, and the carob tree uproots itself and moves. The sages say, we don't bring proof from a carob tree. He says, let this stream of water prove it, and the stream flows backward. They say, we don't bring proof from a stream. He says, let the walls of the study hall prove it, and the walls start to lean inward. Rabbi Yehoshua stands up and tells the walls, when sages are debating, what business do you have to intervene? So the walls stop falling, out of respect for both rabbis, but don't straighten back up, out of respect for Rabbi Eliezer.
That detail about the walls, stopping but not straightening, is so perfect. It's this almost cinematic moment where the physical world is acknowledging the legitimacy of both sides while refusing to resolve the dispute.
Then the climax.
Rabbi Eliezer says, if I'm right, let heaven prove it. And a voice from heaven declares, why do you dispute Rabbi Eliezer? The law is always according to him. And Rabbi Yehoshua stands up and quotes Deuteronomy. It is not in heaven, and says, we pay no attention to a heavenly voice, because the Torah was already given at Sinai, and since then majority rule applies.
The Talmud reports that God, upon hearing this, smiled and said, my children have defeated me.
Which is this staggering moment. The rabbis are claiming that once revelation was given, interpretive authority passed to the human community. God doesn't get to intervene and settle arguments anymore. The arguments themselves, the human process of debate and majority rule, is the mechanism for determining law.
What's so striking about that story is that it's in the Talmud itself. The tradition preserves the story of the tradition declaring its independence from divine intervention. That's an extraordinary level of self-awareness. They could have edited that out. They didn't.
The divinity is in the process, not in the individual opinions.
The framework is divine. The text of the Torah is divine. The authority to interpret is divinely delegated. But the interpretations themselves are human work, and that's not a bug. It's the feature. God wants human beings to do the work.
Which distinguishes Judaism pretty sharply from traditions where the sacred text is understood to have a single correct meaning that's been authoritatively handed down.
This connects to something else I think is important for understanding what Talmud study feels like from the inside. Because the arguments are preserved, and because the minority opinions are still considered part of the tradition, Studying Talmud means you're constantly in conversation with people who disagree with each other. There's no single authoritative voice telling you what to think. You have to navigate the arguments yourself.
Which is why the standard page layout of a printed Talmud is so revealing. You've got the Mishnah and Gemara in the center, but surrounding them are the commentaries. Rashi on one side, the Tosafot on the other, and then layers of later commentators in the margins. The physical page is a visual representation of an ongoing conversation across centuries.
The Vilna edition of the Talmud, which became the standard, has the main text in the middle and then literally wraps it in commentary. You can't read the Talmud without also reading the conversation about the Talmud. The format resists the idea that you can just extract the takeaway and move on. It's like being handed a book where the footnotes have footnotes, and those footnotes are arguing with each other, and some of them were written in 12th century France and others in 16th century Poland.
The typography reinforces this. The main text is in the center in a larger font. Rashi is in a distinctive semi-cursive script on the inner margin. The Tosafot are on the outer margin in a different typeface. Your eye has to learn to track multiple conversations simultaneously. It's a cognitive workout before you've even parsed a single word.
The page itself trains you in the very skill the content demands, holding multiple perspectives in mind at once.
Let me try to synthesize what we've been saying into an answer to Daniel's core question. Religious Jews believe the oral law, the Mishnah, was given at Sinai as part of a divine revelation. The arguments in the Gemara are human attempts to understand, apply, and extend that revelation. Those arguments are considered a sacred endeavor, and both sides of a genuine halakhic dispute are understood to reflect facets of divine truth, even though only one can be followed in practice. The reason the arguments are preserved rather than just the conclusions is that the process of reasoning is itself part of what's valuable. It trains the mind. It preserves minority positions that might become relevant later, and it embodies the principle that human engagement with divine law is meant to be active and contested, not passive.
That's well said, and I'd add one more piece. The preservation of the arguments also reflects a deep commitment to intellectual honesty. The Talmud could have been redacted to present a clean, unified legal code. The fact that it wasn't, that the editors chose to preserve the messiness, tells you something about what they valued. Truth, in this tradition, includes the path you took to get there. Airbrushing the disagreement would be a form of dishonesty.
That's the answer to the second part of Daniel's question, about what learning means. In the secular world, learning typically means acquiring new information, facts you didn't know before. In the Talmudic context, you're working with material that's been studied for 2 millennia. The new thing isn't the text, it's what happens in your mind as you work through it. You're developing the capacity to reason in a particular way, and you're participating in an act that's understood to have religious value in itself.
There's a phrase that gets used, amilut batorah, which means something like laboring in Torah, struggling with it. The struggle is the point. If it were easy, if the conclusions were just handed to you, you wouldn't develop the muscles.
I think that's a concept that actually translates pretty well to secular contexts. Nobody thinks you learn math by reading a list of theorems. You have to work through the problems yourself. The Talmud just takes that insight and elevates it to a religious principle.
It's worth noting that this approach isn't universal within Judaism. Daniel asked about religious Jews, and I've been speaking mainly from an Orthodox perspective. In the Reform and Conservative movements, the relationship to the Talmud is different. They would generally see the Talmud as a human document, brilliant, authoritative for its time, worthy of serious study, but not divinely revealed. The arguments are preserved because they're historically and intellectually significant, but not because they're words of the living God, in the theological sense.
Though even in those movements, the mode of study often looks similar. You're still working through the texts, still engaging with the arguments. The theology around it differs. But the practice of grappling with the material has a staying power that crosses denominational lines.
That's true. And I think it points to something about the Talmud that's easy to miss if you approach it purely as a legal code. It's also a work of literature, of philosophy, of anthropology. The tangents and stories that seem like digressions are often where the deepest insights are hiding.
The Agadah, as opposed to the Halakha.
The Talmud contains enormous amounts of non-legal material, stories about rabbis, ethical teachings, folklore, medical advice, astronomical observations, you name it. And these sections aren't just filler, they're integral to the project. The rabbis who appear in legal debates also appear in stories that show their character, their relationships, their failures. The law and the narrative illuminate each other.
Which adds another reason to preserve the full text rather than just the legal conclusions. You'd lose the human dimension entirely. You'd have a rule book, but not the people who made it, and the people are part of what makes the system work.
The human dimension matters because the Talmud is, among other things, a document about how to build a society. The legal rulings don't exist in a vacuum. They emerge from a community of scholars who knew each other, argued with each other, sometimes resented each other, and were trying to figure out how to live according to what they understood as God's will. There's a story about Rabbi Yohanan and Resh Lakish. Resh Lakish was originally a bandit, and Rabbi Yohanan convinced him to repent and become a scholar. They became study partners and eventually brothers-in-law. But then they had a fierce falling out during a debate, and Resh Lakish died of the grief, and Rabbi Yohanan was inconsolable. The Talmud preserves all of that alongside their legal opinions. It's not just jurisprudence, it's a portrait of intellectual friendship and its costs.
If someone's never opened a page of Talmud, and they're curious where to start, what would you tell them?
I'd say don't try to read it straight through like a book. That's a recipe for frustration. The Talmud assumes you already know a lot, and it jumps around. Find a good teacher, or at least a good English edition with explanatory notes. The Art Scroll Schottenstein edition or the Koren Steinsaltz edition are both excellent. And start with a tractate that has practical relevance or compelling narratives. Something like Berakot, which deals with prayer and blessings, or Pirkei Avot, which is mostly ethical teachings and doesn't require the same legal background.
Pirkei Avot is almost cheating, though. It's the one tractate that reads like wisdom literature you could hand to anyone.
Sure, but that's also why it's a good entry point. It gives you a taste of the rabbinic voice without drowning you in technical legal analysis. And from there, if someone wants to see what actual Talmudic argument looks like, the early chapters of Bava Metzia are classic. They deal with property disputes and have some of the most famous sugyot, including the oven of Akhnai story we mentioned.
I want to pull on one more thread before we wrap up. Daniel's question about what learning means in this context. There's an implication that if the conclusions are already known, the learning might be somehow inauthentic, like going through the motions. But I think the opposite is true. The fact that the conclusions are known is what frees you to focus on the reasoning.
In secular education, you're constantly being tested on whether you got the right answer. In Talmud study, the right answer is already on the page. You're not trying to guess what the conclusion is. You're trying to understand how they got there and why they didn't go the other way. It shifts the entire focus from product to process.
That process orientation has downstream effects on how people think about other things. If you've spent years internalizing the idea that genuine disagreement can be productive, that minority opinions have value, that the reasoning matters as much as the result, that's going to shape how you approach politics, relationships, everything.
There's actually research on this. I've seen studies suggesting that Talmud study develops certain cognitive habits. Tolerance for ambiguity, comfort with multiple perspectives, the ability to hold contradictory ideas in mind without immediately resolving them. Whether or not you buy the theological claims, the intellectual training is real.
Which brings us back to where we started. The Talmud looks chaotic from the outside. Arguments, digressions, unresolved tensions. But that chaos isn't a flaw in the transmission, it's the whole point. The medium is the message.
The medium is the message. I like that. And the message is that law, truth, wisdom, these aren't things you receive. They're things you build, in community across generations, through argument and reconciliation and more argument. The Talmud is the record of that building project, and studying it is how you join the crew.
To Daniel's question, yes, the arguments matter as much as the conclusions, because the arguments are where the divine meets the human, and the learning is in the doing, not just the knowing. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1600s, a subvariant of Kabaddi known as Pharaoh Snatch was briefly documented in the Faroe Islands, where it was called Taka Bert, literally, to take away, and involved a single raider trying to tag sheep shearing stations while holding his breath against the North Atlantic wind.
I have so many questions, and I'm not sure I want answers to any of them.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It genuinely helps other people find the show. We'll be back next time with whatever Daniel throws at us.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.